We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also happy to have back again on the program Sandy Mason. She's a horticulture educator with U of I Extension in Champaign County. Once a month on a Tuesday, she's here and we talk about things that grow in the home landscape. We can take a wide range of questions on ornamental things, turf, shrubs, flowers, things that you can eat, things that really aren't growing right now. Also, we have had questions about houseplants. We can do that too. So maybe, as I always say, maybe you're still thinking about last year. Maybe you had some sort of problem you're just really not sure how to deal with. You're already thinking about next year. Maybe you're thinking about a particular place in your yard, and you're thinking you would like to put something there, but you're not really quite sure what. Maybe you'd like to have a little advice. You can call in and tell us about that spot, and Sandy might be able to suggest something to you. And any and all kinds of growing thing questions, you can give us a call. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So that's the toll-free line. And then we can take emails now. You can write us at will-talk@illinois.edu. It just would help us if you can try to keep them on the short side. But other than that, we'll be happy to take your calls. Hey, good to see you again. Thanks very much.
Hey, good morning.
So we were just talking here, Sandy and I were just talking a little bit about the fact that she had just recently been in Florida. And it's really, really tough and really sad for the people that grow produce, some of the stuff that we like to have here, oranges and tomatoes and things, because they had a prolonged bout of really cold weather.
Mm-hmm. And I was fairly far south in Florida, is the Fort Myers, Bonita Springs area, which is fairly far south in Florida. And there used to maybe a couple nights where it might get close to freezing or whatever, and they might use an irrigation system or something to try to keep things warm. But this was prolonged. It was like six nights where they had to worry about frost. And that's just really unusual for them. So I think they were all feeling a little bit shell-shocked after when I was down there.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And a lot of stuff made it. It looks like the orange trees themselves, unless they were young trees. The young trees were kind of an issue for them. And that's even true for us, you know, when we had this really prolonged cold period for us, that generally the younger plants are the ones that aren't as well established. So often those are the ones that get hit the hardest because they don't have the extensive root system. And they certainly saw that in Florida, too, where some of the younger plants that they had, you know, older mature plants tend to tolerate it much better. So.
Yeah.
So it's just really tough, but it's interesting to see how everybody kind of goes through. We were all feeling these cold spells, but at least for us, we weren't trying to grow anything, you know, for
yes.
the most part. We were just
yes.
sort of hanging in there, but, you know, for them, it really was an issue. So we'll probably see some issues, certainly with I was just saying that, you know, things like fresh eating oranges, a lot of them, even though the trees may have made it, a lot of the growers went ahead and picked them, so they'll juice them out rather than having fresh
yeah.
eating oranges. So we'll probably see some issues there where we won't have fresh eating oranges like we normally have from Florida, at least not the quantity. So.
And for us here, because we also had a period where temperatures were really running significantly below average mm-hmm. for a long period of time. So it was cold. It was certainly cold here. Is there any chance that could cause some damage in some of our landscape plants that we will then see later?
I think probably the biggest thing that people will notice, especially if it's anything that actually snow was a good thing. We may not always think about snow being a good thing, but snow is actually a good thing. And, you know, it really does a good job of insulating mm-hmm. Certainly the root systems and the crowns of a lot of plants. If people have some especially marginally hardy plants, especially if they have something like a hydrangea that normally blooms on old wood, some of those that are, especially some of the older varieties of pinks and blues that bloom on the old wood only, they may notice that those flower buds got killed. I'm not sure exactly how cold it got. We may see some issues. The good thing was at least it happened when most things were still dormant. They were completely dormant, and they'll tolerate those colder temperatures more. If as we get farther into the spring, spring will come eventually, you know, and things start to come out of dormancy. And then if we get really cold temperatures, then that's when we see some really severe problems with things like peaches and apricots and some of those that are traditionally a little marginally hardy anyway. Mm-hmm. And it'll be the flower buds, because those are generally the things that aren't as hardy as certainly the plants or stems or leaf buds.
So the plant probably be okay, but then that means you won't
right.
get fruit.
Right, exactly. So we'll see kind of how things go. We never quite know, but at least it did happen when things were completely dormant mm-hmm. as they are going to be, and so they can certainly tolerate some of those colder temperatures. And for some plants, certainly they were more insulated. I think people are going to, you know, as things go along, they just need to really look at their plants. I think probably what we're going to see is some frost heaving. I think that's the thing I'm starting to see as the snow melts. You'll see that some of those crowns of some of your perennials and stuff have actually kind of heaved out of the ground, and you may even see some roots, which is not a good thing. And what I'm telling people is don't, you know, squish them back down, you know, put some mulch over them or soil or something to cover up those roots, because I think we will certainly see some frost heaving, and we'll certainly see some vole damage. Vole is in the V, vole.
The little animals.
Oh, yes, okay. They love to run around underneath snow. Because they're active all winter. And so you may notice that you've had some actually vole damage. And you can see the little runs. They'll actually make these little kind of run areas in turf and stuff underneath the snow. So as snow melts, people may notice some things that have happened over the winter.
Okay. We have a couple of callers, starting with Urbana. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. Yeah. I'm looking ahead to tomato and pepper season.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the only two vegetables I bother growing, because they used to be the only things that critters wouldn't bother, but now it seems like the squirrels grab the green tomatoes, and if they start to turn red, boy, I have a lot of competition between the birds and the squirrels. But even so, I don't seem to get much in the way of peppers or tomatoes anymore, and I don't know if it's just that I have a limited amount of space, whether I need to rotate my garden some more. I do compost a lot. But I hardly get any peppers, and I'm just wondering if it's something about what I'm doing, or whether it's mm-hmm. the weather, or and it always seems a shame that tomato season is so short. I'd like to have tomatoes on July 4th.
Sometimes you can actually get tomatoes. There's actually a variety called 4th of July, which is an early tomato, so you may think about some of those earlier ones that might help.
Tried early girl, but I haven't seen 4th of July around.
Yeah, I guess a few things. The one thing about tomatoes and peppers, both for the most part, they're heat-loving plants. And we've, unfortunately, the last couple of summers, we've had these extended periods of cool temperatures, which we like, but the peppers and tomatoes just don't, you know, really... You know, they're there, but they don't ripen as fast. They tend to not bloom as much, those kind of things. So, you know, some of this is not a whole lot you can do about. It's just kind of the way it is, and it's just the way the weather is. So I'm not sure it's necessarily stuff you've done. I assume these are getting full sun. They're getting plenty of sun. That's not an issue.
Yeah, they have full sun.
Okay. So you may want to think about maybe some different varieties if you want to try some earlier ones. When do you normally plant them and get them out there?
Well, it depends on whether I'm around. Sometimes I've tried putting them in a cold frame that I have, but then I usually end up roasting them.
yeah, that's the other part with cold frames.
I've even tried, but not recently, those water wells,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
little plastic wall thingies, but they spring leaks and they didn't seem to make that much difference.
Right. Well, usually with tomatoes and peppers, I know sometimes people have some great techniques that get them into the ground earlier, but most of the time it's so cool that the plants don't do a whole lot anyway, and the later planted ones catch up with them. But usually you want them at least planted by mid-May. I mean, usually May 10th or so is a really good time to be thinking about getting them out there. So you don't want to wait too long. And certainly, they don't like a whole lot of nitrogen. You really don't want to pump on a whole lot of nitrogen, but certainly compost, as you mentioned before, is a good thing. But I really have an idea that maybe what you've just seen, especially over the last couple of years, is just weather-related, and we just don't have a whole lot of things we can do about that.
On this old house hour, they were showing a couple of weeks ago how Harvard makes compost tea.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Instead of fertilizer, fertilizers.
Yeah, yeah.
And they found that their grass roots were much deeper. They had to water less, and it was much more, the lawns in Harvard were much more resistant to being trampled.
Mm-hmm.
And they showed later how to do it at home. I'm just wondering whether you have any input on it. It doesn't seem to me to make sense to use fish emulsion. Somewhere I saw you could use cattle feed with alfalfa, and you kind of brew it. You could brew it, I guess, in a plastic garbage can. Do you have any thoughts about composting?
Yeah, composting actually is one of those things we're seeing a lot out there. And actually, you can spend an exorbitant amount of money on this equipment that will help you to aerate the compost tea, and it's supposed to be better and all this kind of stuff. My feeling is the jury's still out. And I certainly wouldn't recommend anybody spending a lot of money on these compost tea aerator kinds of things because, again, I think the jury's out. And part of the problem is compost tea is like anything. It's like baking a cake or anything. It depends on what you put in it. And fortunately, or unfortunately, there's lots of stuff out there that you make compost out of. So the end product's going to be different depending on what's put in there. I think it's one of those things I definitely think eventually we'll find this something where we can use it. We can do it more of like a recipe kind of thing. But I think right now, I think the jury's still out. I have a lot of concerns when people are spraying, especially manure or something like that on their plants, because then we have foodborne illness issues here when we start talking about manure and things. So I just have a lot of concerns when it comes to those things. So I think people are just better off, using compost, working that within their soil and using some of those tried and true kind of methods. And we'll wait and see on the whole compost tea thing.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. And let's see. We'll talk next with somebody in Woodford County, line 4. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I got a question. Last summer would have been the second year we had Japanese beetles up here. And I've got a hybrid American elm, a burning bush hedge, and a buckthorn, fine-line buckthorn shrubs. And I was just curious, I know you have fought them longer down there. Do they eventually back off? And the second part of the question, what do you think of the systemic insecticides that you put in the ground?
Well, I got to tell you, Dave and I were both kind of chuckling a little bit when you said, do they eventually back off? Yes and no. You will see some years that they tend to be worse the first few years, I will tell you that. At least that's what they found. The first couple of years that they're in there, they tend to be a lot worse. And then they seem to, they never go away completely, but then they kind of drop off a little bit. And so some years you'll have them worse than others. Some folks I know last year that normally it had really bad years didn't see hardly any last year. So I think it really depends on a lot of things, maybe the winter, how much wet soil we have, because I think a lot of times the grubs end up dying, those kinds of things. I think a lot of things kind of gone into it. So beyond that, unfortunately, they never go away completely, but you will see drops in populations from time to time. The systemic stuff, I think, is great if you want to go that route. It certainly is an expense. You have to think about the expense issues. Of course, you have to think about the environmental issues and also just the fact that it depends. Most of the time, the Japanese beetle damage is not life-threatening. It doesn't look good, and we don't like it, and, it's really a pain. But most of the time, it doesn't kill the plant off. So you kind of have to decide, is it worth it? Maybe if you have a high-profile plant, as in this is one that's, right at your sidewalk and you have to go underneath it all the time, which isn't much fun when you have Japanese beetles, maybe this is one you want to think about treating. Probably the big thing with the systemics is you want to do it early. You want to do it when the plant is actually taking things up. And so usually we like to have that stuff applied actually by the 1st of March or so. So you want to do it fairly early in the season if you are going to use the systemic. Don't wait until you actually see the Japanese beetles because then you've kind of lost the game.
So what are the environmental concerns? The American elm, I live in the country, I have my own well. The American elm's in the front yard where my well is. Is that something I need to worry about?
It's not so much that. I think what I've seen, at least on some, there's some concerns about, especially using them on lindens. And I think the jury's still kind of out on this. And there's some concerns that maybe some of the beneficial insects that actually feed on the flowers of linden trees may be actually taking up some of the systemic pesticides. So there's those kind of environmental concerns, I guess, is what I'm referring to, is it harming non-target species? So things like, bees or beneficial insects and those. And so there's still some concerns along those lines. I saw it more in relation to linden trees because lindens have actually very small flowers, but they have a lot of pollen. They're very, very attractive to a lot of different insects. So
would you use those systemic insecticides on something like grapes where you're going to eat the grapes, or is that no?
Correct. I don't think they're labeled for edibles.
Okay.
I do not think they're labeled for edibles. Okay. So in that respect, then you have to go back to some of the more tried and true kinds of the things that have been around for a lot longer. If you want to go with something like 7 or something like those, is somewhat effective. But usually, sometimes you can actually cover them if it's a non, or you know, if it's something you don't really care, you can actually cover one with some of the floating row covers. I don't know if you know what that is. It's kind of the spun bond material like stuff.
Yeah, but out in the country,
kind of hard to do. Yeah. Everything blows away. I know.
We got a lot of wind out
here. I know.
Here,
and, I know. I'm with
and
you.
I hate spending all summer spraying stuff.
Right. Absolutely. And it is something that, you know, you really have to kind of think twice. But they're very, very attracted. Japanese beetles love grapes, as you know, and they love raspberries and blackberries and a lot of those kinds of plants.
And they love American elms.
And they love, they love elms. Actually, there's not too many things they don't like, to be honest with you. So okay. That ends up being tougher. So, you know, it's one of those things. We don't recommend the traps. That would be the one thing we do not recommend, because we have found that those actually attract more than you'll ever catch. So I wouldn't use those. So you may just be one of those things where you just kind of have to wait and see and how many you get. We do know that the first ones that come in tend to attract more.
Okay.
So if you can control those first ones, and usually they come. Now, where are you located again?
You're Woodford County,
Woodford
north
County.
Of Bloomington.
Okay, so we usually see them the end of June. So usually about the 22nd, 23rd of June is when we start seeing them. So definitely, you know, mid June or so, you want to start looking for them. Control those first ones that come in. Pick off the foliage that gets fed upon, and we do know that if you do that, you'll have fewer later on.
Now, one more question. You said the systemic ones were sort of expensive. My burning bush hedge is like 150 foot long. Is that something that's going to be outrageous to do?
Well, I guess it depends on your definition of outrageous. It is the chemical itself, and it's you apply it according to the size of the plant.
Uh-huh.
And you just have to read the label and see what you think. But, you know, a big bottle of it is going to cost you like $25-$30.
Okay.
You know, for one bottle. And I don't know how much that I don't remember exactly how much that controls, but it'll tell you how large a plant, and then you actually do apply it to the soil. In a watering can and those kind of things. So you have to really kind of think all those things through. And is it really worth it? It's not more than likely going to kill your burning bush. It's just not going to look all that great. But
uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, good luck.
Okay. Thank you. I suppose if there's one thing you can point to as being a positive, if you have a really long period where it's really cold, that might tend to help to keep the numbers down. I know this is something that I've talked about with Phil Nixon, and I don't remember exact temperatures, but there's some kind of deal where if you can get your soil temperature below a certain temperature for a long enough period of time, then some of the insects, as they're overwintering under the soil, will be killed. So maybe then the summer that follows, it won't be quite so bad. That's, you know, there, as you said,
sure.
There are things that influence the numbers, and you could have – they kind of go – up and down depending on the conditions during
right.
that time that they're going through their life cycle in the soil.
Right, and I think the other thing is just the fact that we had so many flooded areas. You know, we hate to see the flooded areas, but those are, you know, the grubs are in the soil. The pupas are in the soil. So, you know, those kinds of things can affect certainly what insects we have later on when we have these really saturated soils. And that could be the other thing, that maybe that'll end up being a good thing, the fact that we had such a wet year for the most part, that might actually be a good thing when it comes to Japanese beetles.
Yeah, okay. Sandy Mason's here. She's a horticulture educator with U of I Extension in Champaign County. And once a month on a Tuesday, she's on the program. We talk about things that grow in the home landscape. So if you have a question for her, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's next talk with someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I've got a question about a plant. Common name is Angel's Trumpet. I think it's Datura meta.
Mm-hmm.
How toxic are the fruit, and how much of an attractant are they?
Attractant to what?
Children.
I would be very concerned having any of the Daturas around kids, especially young kids that tend to put stuff in their mouth. I'd be very concerned.
That's what I was wondering about.
Yep. I'd be very concerned. And it's definitely one of those things that, you know, they're in the nightshade family and there's some big issues with those guys. So, yeah, I would be very concerned about that. And
the
seeds are pretty big. They would be attractive to kids.
Mm-hmm. They're beautiful plants.
They're gorgeous plants. And they've become very popular. You see them all over the place. So, you know, the big, because the flowers are so big and exotic and people love them for that. But, you know, we do have to think sometimes about these things. So that's a good reminder. I'm glad you mentioned that.
I was thinking of taking the farmer's market, and I'm wondering, probably better caution people and suggest they do plant them and their children, they should pick the fruit off?
Sure. I think it definitely either pick the fruit off or just, because, you know, the leaves are certainly an issue too. The fruit's probably worse, but mm-hmm. But it'd probably be a plant that I would probably not have if I had young children, to be honest with you. It's definitely for someone that doesn't have to worry about those kind of things. And even for animals, if you have animals that tend to chew on every single thing, they might be concerned about that. But there's plenty of us out there that don't have little kids or whatever that can enjoy those plants.
Well, I think I'll put them in and just remind people.
Yeah, I think it's probably good to just remind people, just give them a little bit of warning, that's fine.
Thanks,
so great. Sure.
All right, thank you. On to Danville, line number two. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I am in Danville, and I know to rotate my tomato plants around my garden, but in my very favorite tomato bed, I rotate about every 2 to 3 years they land there. And this last summer, they were terrible, and I know that everyone had issues. But whenever I cleaned out my garden and pulled them up, the roots were just almost non-existent.
Mm-hmm.
And they just looked really tortured and turned around and spotty. And I'm thinking, okay, sounds like nematodes. So I guess my question is, would that be a reasonable assumption, A? B, how do I know that that's what I have? And C, what can I do about it?
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd necessarily assume it was nematodes. I think, because certainly, you know, we had some wet weather, and just root rot would do something like that as well.
Well, but these are in a raised bed, and they had decent drainage.
So, okay.
I thought.
Yeah. But even places with decent drainage had some issues last year, unfortunately. So, so maybe certainly raised beds will help drainage issues. So I'd be a little bit concerned about that. And then what to do about it. I think probably rather than just automatically assuming it's nematodes, you can buy varieties and it'll say VFN, you know, on the label.
I had planted Supersonic and I thought Supersonic wasn't.
I don't know the designation. I have memorized all the designations on all of them. But VFN, you know, for Verticillium and Fusarium and nematodes.
Right. Well,
so sometimes they're just listed as VF and not VFN. So I will tell you sometimes, you know, depending on how you look at the label. So that would be one you might want to check on. If it did show that it was VFN, then the likelihood is much less, obviously. It's not totally out of the question, but the likelihood would be less that they would have nematodes. So I guess I would think about those kinds of things and just making sure, you know, if you want to add compost to the soil, I don't know if you normally do that, but just anything that you sort of help to enrich the soil so that you've got nice, healthy soil, I think it's going to help too. So I wouldn't necessarily assume nematodes. What you might do in the future is that you might just actually take a sample of the plant clinic. Normally they're open May through September. So depending on when you know, if you do have problems, sometimes it's a good idea to find out, especially if you have it again, where it seems like it's doing the same thing.
Is there nothing then that I can do now to sort of preemptive sort of thing?
Usually with those, especially, you know, Verticillium, Fusarium, and nematodes, really for the most part, we look at resistant varieties and we look at crop rotation.
Okay.
So beyond that. So.
Okay.
Yeah, I know. Sometimes it's really tough, but I do think a lot of our problems from last year had to do, it just wasn't a great growing tomato year. You know, I think a lot of people complained. I heard over and over again where people said that their tomatoes just weren't growing or they weren't ripening.
Right.
And so sometimes.
So if I were to put another root, all right, if I were to put my dahlias there, for example, where I do care about the tubers,
mm-hmm.
Would I have... Do you think I'd have good luck, or should I just go with beans and above root, you know, vegetables and so on above? Right?
Well, nematodes and actually a lot of those things don't necessarily go to everything. So sometimes they're quite specific on certain crops. So that's why we can do crop rotation on those things. I think I'm understanding your question as in you're concerned that maybe other things might get the same issue. I think if you go with something completely different, you know, staying away from the from that tomato family, so staying away from eggplants and tomatoes and peppers and all those guys, you know, just to be on the safe side, I think you'd be fine.
Well, if I do have nematodes, do they eventually just disappear, or do I always have to stay away from those plants in that space?
Number one, I think I would really find, before we make those kinds of assumptions, do they ever completely go away? Probably not. The problem is that as you plant the same plant over and over and over again, if you were to plant tomatoes over and over again and they got nematodes, the populations keep rising by doing that. Basically, you're almost trying to starve things out by doing a crop rotation.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
All right, thank you. We're
thank
at our
you
midpoint.
For the show.
Oh, sure. Midpoint here with Sandy Mason. If you have plant questions, you can give us a call 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Sandy is a horticulture educator with U of I Extension in Champaign County, and she's here on the program once a month. And we encourage people to call with these sorts of questions. We have someone ready to go now in Mattoon on the toll free line. Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah.
I've got a couple of questions. One is when to start working on the yard fertilizer and seeding a few bare spots and maybe some kind of fertilization. And then second, I've got a number of seeds left over from last year, garden seeds, grass seeds, and they've been in a warm place all winter. I just wonder, are they still usable?
Well, I'll answer your last question first, I guess. As far as the leftover seeds, as long as they've been stored properly, as in not too wet, not too dry, I mean dry, not too wet, and not too cold, they should be fine.
Yeah, they've been in
absolutely should be
garage.
Fine. Yeah, they'll be fine. So I wouldn't worry about it. Sometimes you'll see a little bit of a drop in germination rate. I don't know. You said some of these are vegetables and things or grass seed and...
What, grass seed and beans?
Oh,
beans?
Sure. What you may notice on some of those things, sometimes if they're seed from the year before, you'll notice the germination rate goes down. So as opposed to getting, you know, 85% of the seeds germinating, you only get 80%. Well, most of the time we have more seeds than we can possibly use anyway. So you might want to, when you plant them, you might plant them a little extra thick. And that's easy enough to do normally because we have plenty of seeds. So I think that's fine. If they've been stored, I really wouldn't worry about that part too much.
Spinach
so I totally use them. Pardon?
Spinach and lettuce seeds?
Spinach, lettuce, certainly. You still go, usually those are another one of those that starts, the germination rate starts to drop. You know, onions and some of those are probably some of the worst when it comes to, you know, they just don't have a very good germination rate if they've been saved. But again, we use plenty of seeds, just plant them a little extra thick. And I think you'll be fine with those. As far as grass seed and stuff, as far as when to get going on those, usually we say April is a good time because you want this, you know, I know I've heard people say, you know, put the grass seed out on the snow. But if you think about it, that's, you know, not such a great idea because then it's, you know, it suffers all kinds of ills and could be just really expensive bird seed.
Well, I got a few spots in shaded areas that I need to treat.
Yeah. So usually April is a good month to be thinking about reseeding things. That's
okay.
Really a good month. To do just regular, you can actually fertilize at that time. It's usually not at the same rate, usually at a lower rate. If you're just going to fertilize your whole lawn, usually we say the 1st of May.
I see.
To fertilize your whole lawn.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
All right, very good. Other questions are welcome. Again, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Email well-talk@illinois.edu. And I was looking at one of your recent columns, and it's the one that's up on the website, so I'm actually not sure how recent it is, but it's the one where you're talking about, well, it's one for January 13th, so I guess that is the pretty recent, saying some interesting things about how you think about hardiness of plants, and then also how you think about your home landscape. And I'm presuming that if you buy a plant in a local garden center, they wouldn't stock it if they thought it wouldn't survive where you're living. She's giving me a funny look. But that also doesn't, you know, but that then you also might want to think about if you have some flexibility where you're going to plant it, then what you want to do is look at your yard as a total thing, because you'd say, and I think probably anybody who really is a serious gardener knows that, that you can have microclimates within your home landscape. There are places that are just – that are very different. They get different sun, and they may be more or less well-drained. You know, conditions are really different, and one plant could do really well in one spot and just not someplace else.
Right.
So particularly, I guess I'm thinking about this question of where – if you have something that you feel might be just a little on the tender side, how do you look around and say – what would be the best spot for something like
right,
that?
Right, right. It really, you know, a lot of it, it depends. It all depends. You know, usually anything like, well, obviously, some things may be obvious, like courtyards or stuff, where they're really protected all the way around, or if you have areas maybe that are near a brick house, the brick house on the south side, those areas tend to warm up faster. Now, you know, and in some respects that helps. But the other thing that I have found is that, unfortunately, for some of our plants, their biggest problem is they wake up too early. And what I have found on some of those plants, you're actually better off on ones that tend to be, especially things like magnolias or something, that tend to wake up a little bit too early, and then they get some problems with their flower buds actually freezing off. You're actually better off if they don't wake up so early. So what I have found, sometimes it's actually better to put those on a little colder spot. Or make sure that they're mulched. So the whole idea is that sometimes it's good to have those warm spots, and especially if you're going to cover something and those kind of things, you're actually probably in really good shape. You know, if you're actually going to cover it to the point where it doesn't wake up too early. So I think those kinds of things you really kind of have to think about. And I'm not sure I'm answering your question very well, but I think people will find out really quick, especially if you have like daffodil bulbs or whatever, you'll notice in one spot they always come up faster than anywhere else. So sometimes that's a good thing because, you know, it's warmer. You can use that to your benefit by having these, you know, marginally hardy plants. But then the other side of it is that you may want to go ahead and cover them anyway, just for the fact that they don't wake up so early. Yeah. So, you know, making sure that they have mulch or something like that so that the ground doesn't warm up too fast and they actually sprout out too early and then you have issues with late frosts.
Yeah. Okay.
So there's one of those things. I think a lot of it is sort of just getting to know your own yard. And I think sometimes that's really hard, especially if you're new to the area or whatever. But sometimes you'll find out really quick, through a few instances.
All right.
But then I always figured that's a shopping opportunity.
That's what the column says. I like here at the end you say an old garden adage is you have to kill a plant at least three times before you consider it not hardy.
See?
All right.
You just keep moving it around.
All right. We'll go back here to the phones. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Hi, Sandy. I know that you've been the guide on a lot of tree walks in our area, and I'm wondering if you've ever noticed anyone growing a Stewardia tree. I'm really interested in planting one, but I don't know if I can make it happy here in central Illinois. I didn't know if you'd ever noticed any in our area. And I'm also interested in the yellow flowering magnolia trees, wondering how they do here.
Yeah, actually, Stewardias are beautiful. They have gorgeous bark, as you've figured out by looking at the pictures and stuff, I'm sure. And, you know, I think it's one of those things that I've never seen one here. Maybe somebody can call in and tell us that they have one. So I think there may be some marginal issues, but I'm trying to think of where I was. I was somewhere in some botanic garden, and I was surprised they had a Stewardia. And I'm trying to think of where it was, but it was a place that was colder than I thought they would tolerate. So I know they're probably not the cheapest things in the world, but I think it's probably worth it if you have that kind of, you know, semi-protected area to really sort of think about those. Because the one thing with those, of course, is you want them to get big enough that you can actually finally see the bark and, you know, how beautiful they are. So I don't know what to tell you on that one. That would definitely be a bit of a gamble, but maybe somebody can call in and tell us they have a beautiful Stewardia somewhere. And then the yellow-flowered magnolias, I've seen really good results with the yellow-flowered. I think there's one called Elizabeth, maybe, that actually has some really good hardiness to it. So I think those are definitely worth looking into.
Have you actually seen them?
I'm trying to think. I have not seen one here, but I remember doing a little bit of research on them and thought there's no reason why they shouldn't be here. I'm just not sure they're as available, maybe. Maybe there's an availability issue.
Well, my garden catalogs have quite a wide variety of them, so I'm pretty tempted.
So, yeah, what hardiness zone are they giving them?
Mm-hmm.
Did they say
20?
Minus 20? Wow.
Yeah.
So you'd think it'd definitely be one of those that I would definitely think, because the big problem is, you know, with magnolias is that they wake up too early and then the the buds get frosted off, and then we never get to enjoy the flowers. Right. That's definitely one that I, you know, I would probably put on like the, you know, east side of the house or something where it's going to get a little protection, and then hopefully not wake up too early, make sure it's mulched, those kind
good
of things.
Good idea.
Yeah. Good luck.
All right. Thank you.
Let me know how it works out.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you. To Champaign County. This is the next caller, line four. Hello.
Hi. Hi. I think this works for nematodes. My grandfather used to truck farm a bit, and he got his carrots straight by alternating marigolds with
carrots. Yeah, now that you say that, I'm not sure on if it works on all nematodes, but they have found some issues, certainly some good things about using marigolds for nematodes. So, yeah, that's a good thing. She could do a marigold bed, and it'd be beautiful, and then she wouldn't have to worry about their nematodes. So, yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that.
It's the natural pyrethrins, right?
Yeah, there's something. Yeah, they actually found something in the roots, and I had seen that listed. So I'm glad you mentioned that.
The other thing was about plants waking up too soon. I don't see a lot of marigolds that are like wrapped or insulated. And the theory of this in fruit tree places is that you don't want the sap to rise too soon, so you actually insulate it against the warming of the springish, late winterish sun.
I'm not sure I gathered what you just, the first part of what you said.
Wrapping the base.
Wrapping the bark?
The actual trunk. The theory being that you prevent the trunk from warming as fast as it would if it wasn't clothed, as it were. And that supposedly keeps the sap down longer, and then you consequently, the tree wakes up later and you get a more likely... You haven't heard of this?
I haven't heard wrapping for that reason. Usually wrap trees, the idea is for frost cracking. And it's the bark will literally crack if we get a really, really cold spell, and then we get a warm spell where we get a lot of sun, then especially on young trees, you'll literally see a frost crack.
Well, I understand that. But I hadn't really seen it from insulating, like not a foam material, but something that has more insulative capability. So it's not only... And that I don't know if it works, and I'm curious that it actually keeps the sap from rising sooner and the plant is later.
I guess what I have found is that it's more important to actually do mulching and stuff on the roots so that the soil itself doesn't warm up too fast. And I have had much better luck doing those kind of things rather than wrapping them. So that's interesting.
One outgoing thing that you could maybe elaborate on if you don't have time, and that's starting plants inside. I bought one of these frames for plastic covered, and I was thinking putting a heating pad in the bottom and making a germinating flatbed kind of thing. And if there's any tips or insights that you have on that,
better.
So I don't damp out so much. I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Yeah, actually, this is a good time to start thinking about those kind of things. So that's a good suggestion too, as far as starting plants indoors, because some of them actually take a long time. Especially if you're doing something like, I don't know, begonias and some of those things, and patience take a long time. Probably the biggest thing, you know, you were mentioning, probably the biggest thing is disease issues, because some damping off is the one thing you mentioned. And usually a couple of things you can do to take care of that. I have much better success if I use soilless mixes, actually germination-type mixes that actually don't have soil in them. I've had much better luck using those so I don't get the disease. And if anybody's ever had damping off, it's very, very unsettling, because the little seedlings come up and they look great, and then the next day, they just fall over, and there's actually a fungus that attacks right where the soil and the plant kind of come together there at that soil line, and so they just fall over. So it's really disheartening. So usually damping off can help by good drainage in the soil that you have. Also, sometimes if you just put a little fan in there just to get a little air circulation going, sometimes that will help. So usually with those kind of things, you can usually do a pretty good job of sort of taking care of that and just watching, you know, how much moisture. You want them to be moist, but not too moist, especially once the seedlings pop up. So usually that's enough. But making sure that you have some sort of supplemental light with fluorescence is probably going to be the biggest thing. You really can't do it on the windowsill very well at all. So you really need some kind of fluorescent light. We just have too many dreary days like today to do those kinds of things.
10-12 minutes left in this part of Focus. Sandy Mason is our guest. She's a horticulture educator with U of I Extension in Champaign County. We're taking questions on things that grow in the home landscape. If you've got questions, give us a call, 333-9455. And toll free, 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Belgium. Line two. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. Mm-hmm. a previous caller just a few minutes ago mentioned that you do a tree walk.
Mm-hmm.
And this is inside Champaign or Urbana.
Yes.
Would you happen to know if anybody has a laburnum tree?
Boy, I don't know. Not that I have seen on the certainly not on the tree walk. And actually, these tree walks are both, one's through the city of Urbana, one's through the city of Champaign. Actually, people can go to their websites and get information about both of those tree walks. There's actually guides. People can do self-guided guides. I don't know. I have not seen that, to be honest with you, to see if there's one of those around.
Well, Liburnum is mainly located in the Southern Europe Mediterranean area, but it's very popular in England as a garden tree
because mm-hmm.
it's long lived and it's nice pretty tree, but it also has beautiful wood for turning
mm-hmm.
and pieces that are cut off can be used for wood turning.
Yeah, I don't even know what the hardiness zone is on those.
No, it does grow in the United States in places, but it has to be introduced.
Yeah.
It's not native at all.
Right. So that would, you know, the problem is for some things, it's not, you know, winter hardiness is just part of the story, which we find out over and over again. And a lot of it has to do with our soils, for some plants, are just too good. They like rockier soils. They don't like really wet soils, especially in wintertime, those kind of things. So sometimes we have issues, even though they might be winter hardy, we have issues because our soils are just too good. They like those, especially Mediterranean plants, they like those rocky areas, so.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
thank you.
And we were just talking about different plants. I did happen to think there are some, which we normally would never think about, some of the big flowered magnolias. The evergreen magnolias are actually around here. And once in a while, they'll flower. But I have seen a few of those around. You know, the great big magnolias that we think of, you know, as southern states.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
There actually are a few of those around.
Okay. Well, again, we'll go to another caller, Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. A couple of questions. One, how hard are service berry trees to start, or bushes, whatever, in this area?
From, are you thinking about starting your own, like from a seed or something? Or,
well,
or just getting the plant?
I was going to get a plant, but...
Oh, they do great around here.
Yeah, I know there are a lot around. Do they need any special soil, like blueberries need more acid soil? Or?
No. They're actually native. So they do very well. They do well in service berries are just great small trees. Now, I think probably the biggest thing with service berries is there's a couple different species out there in the trade. So you really have to, you know, make sure you look at the label because some of them are more shrubby-like and some of them are more tree-like. So you really have to look at the label closely, make sure you're getting the one that you want. Both of them do very well. They actually do well in the shade. They're normally an understory plant in forested areas. So beautiful spring flowers, great tasting berries. The birds like them, but I actually have had some years where the berries were so prolific, I actually added them to some blueberries, made a pie out of them. They're very good.
Oh, yeah. You can pretty much eat them like blueberries.
They're tasty. Yeah, very tasty.
There's a place by the University of Chicago where they've got a whole row of bushes by the medical center where they just drop off the bushes practically. So you can grow them in a shady yard under trees?
Sure, they do very well, and they're really great fall color. Really, doesn't seem to be a whole lot of problems with them that I've seen.
Great. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then I have some like four beds in my front yard, and I grew tomatoes with some success, peppers with almost no success, and eggplant with no success anyway. And then I grew them in a bed with squash, which is one of the reasons they didn't do well, but the others because they were overwhelmed by the huge squash.
Mm-hmm.
But my question is, do I need to move the squash as well as the nightshade plants, or can I leave the squash in that bed and just move the nightshades?
You're talking in relation to crop rotation, or?
Yeah.
Okay. It depends on what you want to do. So you don't necessarily have to move them all. Usually when we think about crop rotation, we're talking about rotating between families. So the squash is in a different family than tomatoes and stuff. So you've hit upon the problem that you had last year in the sense that squash tends to need a lot of space.
Yeah.
They're not very good neighbors.
No, they're not.
They take over everything.
Well, the tomatoes grew up in this little fence I had in the bed. But strawberries I planted... And which I didn't expect to bear last year, but still. And the eggplant and the pepper were just totally overwhelmed by the squash, and the squash also climbed up on the fence. So it was very pushy.
They're exuberant. They're very exuberant
plants. Yeah, and they sort of walk around your garden. They escape from the bed, and they just kind of walk around the paths. And,
They do have... Yeah, I'm not sure what squash you had, but they do have some that are actually more confined, more compact. They still probably need a, 4 by 4 foot space, so they still aren't exactly small plants. But there are some smaller varieties, especially some of the acorn squash and some of those. So you might if you're really having issues with, because everybody has the same issue where they just don't have enough space for traditional squash. So there's some newer ones out there.
But won't hurt the squash to grow 2 years on the same bed?
Pardon?
It won't be bad for the squash in terms of pathogens or whatever to grow 2 years on the same bed?
You know, if you didn't have problems with them last year as far as some big insect or disease problems, I wouldn't worry about them.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. And another champagne caller here, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm enjoying the opportunity to talk about magnolias because everybody plants the same old two kinds and there are so many wonderful ones out there. There's a big magnolia butterflies on First Street. On the west side of the six-pack, in front of one of those dorms there.
Mm, okay.
I think it's the northernmost one along First Street. And it flowered gorgeously last year. There used to be a great big one in the cemetery south of Pennsylvania, but the stupid cemetery people cut it down. But there are other unusual magnolias in the southeast corner of that cemetery. The main one that's really neat and really unusual is called Woodsman. When the buds come out, they're chocolate brown.
Oh, wow.
And then when they open up, they kind of turn to kind of a brownish, lavender, greenish combination. It's just incredibly neat.
So which cemetery is this again?
It's east of 4th Street, south of Pennsylvania.
So in Urbana?
From Pennsylvania to Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And in the southeast corner, the Joe McDaniel was a professor at the U of I who developed a lot of magnolias.
Right.
And near his grave there, a lot of them have been planted. And unfortunately, the cemetery cut a lot of them down. But Woodsman is still there. It's poorly pruned, but it's gorgeous. I have butterflies in my yard. I live out in the country, so it's out in the wind, out in the crop spray, and it does wonderfully.
Oh, cool.
Some years the frost gets the flowers, but most years it doesn't. And then another great place to see magnolias, unusual ones, is Wesley Whiteside lives east of Charleston, 5 miles east of Charleston, and he has a garden walk. He has 5 acres of everything wonderful, and he has a garden walk every Memorial Day weekend run by the Coles County Historical Society. And anybody who's at all interested in plants who's never gone should go. It's just incredible. He has, the big leaf magnolias, not the evergreen, the deciduous kind.
Mm-hmm.
He has every species of those, and they're usually in flower for the garden walk. And the flowers are the size of dinner plates. It's just wonderful just to go for that, but then he has so much more. I think he has a stewardia, too.
Oh, there you go.
And for the laburnum guy, most of the really good woody plant catalogs from the West Coast and the East Coast, like New Jersey or the Seattle, Washington area, you can mail order laburnum plants, but also Spring Hill, that catalog that most people get, they have laburnum plants, and he should try planting them because he's over near the edge of the state, and so being a little farther east gets a little more rainfall. The trouble with them is our hot summers kill them.
They
can't take our hot summers, and they need a little more acidic soil, but they are gorgeous plants and worth trying. There used to be one in a front of a house in Urbana in like maybe on Nevada or somewhere along in there, straight east of Lincoln, maybe 5 blocks, but it's gone.
Oh,
it's
okay.
The only one I've seen.
I was going to say, it might have been Professor Durr's old house.
No, he didn't have a laburnum.
But thanks.
He had a little bit of everything
else. It's worth it. Yeah.
Okay.
And that's fun to try those different plants because, just to see, because sometimes, we're surprised when we can sort of stretch things, and especially with newer varieties and stuff, things like magnolias and we certainly were very fortunate to have a professor that was into magnolias.
Yeah. Well, I thank you very much, and we got time for at least one more caller. We'll take the person here in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
We had a question about we have a couple acres that we want to put berry bushes on the outside, and you had mentioned or along the boundary. You had mentioned the service berry, and we were wondering about, are those tolerant to things like crop spray, wind, all that kind of thing?
Well, I have several of them, and I'm out in the country, and I haven't had any problem with that kind of thing. So are you wanting to eat these yourself? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we're wanting them for human consumption.
Yeah.
Also birds.
Sure. I was going to say, they're one of those that you really kind of have to fight the birds for, because they'll pick them off just as fast as anything, but that's fine. But no, I have mine, and they're right on the edge of my property, and they get all those things and don't seem to have a problem.
And they seem to make it. Have you heard anything about, I saw that there's a hybrid called an Illini blackberry. Have you heard anything about
that?
Good?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're good. They still have some of the thornless blackberry kind of issues sometimes, where they're not as hardy as others. But certainly, go for
it. Okay. And the last question is, what about just suggestions for where to find these types of plants and starts and stuff like that around here?
You're talking about for fruit plants or for?
For the fruiting bushes, stuff like that.
Well, you know, it depends on if you're looking for very specific varieties, you may have to, you know, certainly a lot of the local places will have, you know, some varieties of blueberries or whatever, but you tend to be more limited. There's a couple of other places, certainly, you know, Starks, it's gone through a couple of different hands now, but it still seems to have a fairly decent catalog. I think there's a place called Indiana Berry. And so there's a few places out there that certainly, I think if you go on the U of I Extension's website and go to their berry section, I think it lists some sources out there too. So if you're looking for very specific varieties, you'll probably find you have to order them.
Okay, over the web or something.
Right, or catalogs. A lot of times they'll certainly send you the catalog. So there's
okay.
Some.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Thank you.
All right, thanks very much. Well, there, I think we'll have to stop for this time around as we're come to the end of the time here. If folks have questions like this, they can look for the extension person near them. So it might be Sandy, could be somebody else. They're in the phone book. Also, if you go to the website of U of I Extension, there is a lot of information on horticulture topics and other things. Anything in the way of events that you might want to mention?
Well, I did want to mention that the Crawford County Master Gardeners are having their Winter Day in the Garden on January 23rd, and that's in Robinson, Illinois. And they always have really good programs, and they can go to the Crawford County Extension site and get some more information about that. The Mid-America Horticulture Trade Show up at McCormick Place is starting the 20th, so that's the 20th through the 22nd. So if people have a lot of interest in maybe some, you know, industry kind of things, the Mid-Am show is kind of the place to go. So that's coming up soon. So.
Sandy Mason, she's horticulture educator with U of I Extension in Champaign County. She's here once a month on a Tuesday. Thanks very much.
Thank you.